Mr. President, let me start by thanking Senator Tom Harkin, distinguished chairman of our committee, and the ranking Republican member Saxby Chambliss for their leadership. It is not an easy task to be chairman or ranking member of the Senate Agriculture Committee during a farm bill. And having served in both capacities, I know well the challenges that both have faced in putting together a bill. Let me point out, as I have during the debate in committee, some achievements have occurred. Both the chairman and ranking member have outlined a number of these in the areas of conservation, rural development, research, nutrition, and energy. I'm also pleased by the effort to provide interested farmers with a revenue-based program that should be an improvement over the status quo. However, the farm bill we have before us does not provide meaningful reform. Our current farm policies sold the American public as a safety net actually hurt the family farmer. In the name of maintaining the family farm and preserving rural communities, today's farm programs have benefited a select few, while leaving the majority of farmers without support or a safety net. Let me review the history of these farm bills. The genesis of our current farm policies began during the Great Depression as an effort to help alleviate poverty among farmers and rural communities. At that time, one in four Americans lived on a farm, and the rural economy's vitality was largely dependent upon farmers. Farm programs were instituted that stifled agricultural productivity in order to raise commodity prices through a federally administered supply and demand program. Supply control programs cost U.S. taxpayers handsomely in higher food costs and job loss, and now about half of the nation's farmers are essentially prevented from growing other crops such as fruits and vegetables. To date, this same antiquated idea is promoted even though farm income is higher on average than other industries. Times have changed dramatically since then. Today, one in 75 Americans lives on a farm, and only one in every 750 lives lives on a full-time commercial farm. Now, furthermore, nearly 90% of total farm household income comes from off-farm sources. 90%. In response to these ongoing changes, in 1996, Congress finally recognized that farmers, not the government, could best ascertain what crops are profitable and granted roughly half of our farmers flexibility in planting choices, the so-called Freedom the Farm Bill, and began to transition away from federally controlled agriculture programs. But in 2002, Congress and the Bush administration reversed these reforms and created the so-called, quote, three-legged stool, end of quote, which in addition to other farm programs has helped to place us in violation of our WTO commitments. The Senate Agriculture Committee Farm Bill before us today perpetuates and even expands these defective policies without regard for the fact that the majority of farmers do not have a safety net. The first leg of this so-called three-legged stool is direct payment subsidies to specific farmers who grow certain crops. Direct payments are fixed annual taxpayer-funded subsidies that are based on a farm's historic production and a federally set payment rate. For the five major subsidized crops, the average payment rate is roughly $15 per acre for wheat, $24 per acre for corn, $33 per acre for cotton, $11 per acre for soybeans, and $94 per acre for rice. These subsidies were originally called transition payments. They were meant to be a temporary bridge from supply management-based subsidies to free market-based agriculture. They were never intended to be a continuing entitlement. Direct payment policies are particularly irresponsible because the taxpayer-funded subsidies go out to farmers regardless of whether cash is flowing in or out of their farms or whether they farm at all. Although many subsidized farmers are projected to receive record crop prices and earn record farm incomes over the next 5 years, the Senate Farm Bill, as agreed to by the Senate Agriculture Committee, doles out up to $26 billion in direct payments from taxpayers, much of which will go to some of the largest and wealthiest farming operations in America. In fact, over 50% of these subsidies will continue to go to farmers in just 7 states for a grand total of $13.1 billion. Now, some may find these statistics surprising, but this is simply a continuation of business as usual when it comes to farm subsidies. Keep in mind that in the years 2000 to 2005, the farm sector received $112 billion in taxpayer subsidies, but only 43% of all farms received payments. This is because the majority of the payments go to just 5 row crops, corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton, and rice. The largest 8% of these farms receive 58% of these payments. In fact, the top 1% of the highest earning farmers claim 17% of the crop subsidy benefits between 2003 and 2005. Smaller farms that qualify in the current system and that could benefit from additional support did not do as well. 2/3 of recipient farms received less than $10,000, accounting for only 7% of their gross cash farm income. Minority farmers fared even worse, with only 8% of minority farmers even receiving federal farm subsidies. Furthermore, half of the federal crop subsidies paid between 2003 and 2005 went to only 19 congressional districts out of 435. Each one of these statistics illustrates that our direct payment system is inequitable and in conflict with claims you will hear on the Senate floor that our current farm policies are a safety net for the family farmer. The second leg of the stool is, quote, counter-cyclical payments, end of quote, or having the taxpayer pay farmers when prices fall below a congressionally set price. The third leg is a marketing loan program that allows farmers to put their crops up as collateral to receive operating capital. However, provisions allow farmers to go ahead and sell the crop and repay the government at a lower rate, leaving taxpayers to make up the difference. Because these two programs do not appropriately correspond with market forces, they have the effect of creating artificial markets for crops, even when markets do not exist. Yet neither program provides any help to farmers when they arguably need it most. During disasters such as drought. Of greater concern, these programs have been ruled to violate our trade agreements, but this new farm bill actually increases target prices for at least 5 crops, loan rates for 7 crops, and adds a number of new subsidized crops. Now, some senators may wonder why we should be concerned that we are in violation of our World Trade Organization, our WTO commitments. They might think that this situation is simply limited to agriculture, or specific crops with little impact on our overall economy. Others might even suggest that we are better off building up more barriers to trade. That this farm bill is about American farmers, and not farmers in Brazil or elsewhere. However, if senators look further down the line, they will see that our WTO violations could cost the United States billions in revenue, intellectual property, and lost trade opportunities. And failure to move toward compliance will invite retaliatory tariffs that legally can be directed at any U.S. industry. In fact, this is happening now. Brazil will soon have the authority to retaliate in kind against United States products, whether they be agricultural products or intellectual property, due to our unwillingness to fix our farm policies. It is unclear if Brazil will follow through with these threats, but what is clear is the WTO has repeatedly found the United States cotton program to be in violation of our commitments. As a result, a host of challenges to other agricultural commodities have ensued, including a case brought forth by Brazil and Canada in November that targets all of our commodity programs. Upon the initial findings of the WTO, Congress did repeal some cotton-related programs found to violate these agreements, namely the so-called Step 2 program, which was a program that used taxpayer money to pay companies to use U.S. cotton. However, the farm bill we are currently considering makes virtually no attempt to bring the rest of the cotton program into compliance. The administration earlier this year put forth a number of policy changes that they argue would have fixed our trade problems with the WTO, including a revenue-based counter-cyclical program, marketing loans that respond to market prices, and eliminating planting restrictions for fruits and vegetables. None of these proposals were incorporated into either the House or the House of Representatives bill or the farm bill from the Senate before us today. In fact, this farm bill significantly increases the likelihood that other programs will be further challenged by the World Trade Organization. Specifically, the WTO found that countercyclical payments and marketing loans are trade distorting, and the direct payments, argued to be trade neutral, are a trade violation, as long as planting restrictions are retained. Astonishingly, the farm bill increases payments made under these trade-distorting programs almost across the board, further exacerbating our trade situation. In the midst of all of this, the United States Department of Agriculture's chief economist projects that exports of agricultural products for this year are likely to reach $79 billion. Nearly 30% of all farm cash receipts in 2007, nearly 40% of soybeans, half of our wheat, and over 90% of our cotton produced in the United States this year will be exported. Clearly, trade and our trading partners are important to American farmers now and will continue to be in the future. U.S. action to comply with WTO rulings against cotton subsidies, as well as U.S. policy regarding subsidies in general, will be closely monitored by the world's exporters. Should the WTO determine that other U.S. farm subsidy programs, as challenged by Brazil and Canada, do not comply with WTO rules, the potential for retaliation by other countries is immeasurable. Now, Mr. President, the farm bill before us today establishes a new permanent disaster trust fund at the Department of the Treasury to provide an additional $5 billion in spending for commodity crop farmers. Our amendment does not touch this provision, nor any of the other provisions related to the Finance Committee package. Of this $5 billion, it's estimated that nearly half of the money will be given to farmers in counties designated as disaster counties by the president. And the other half will go to crop insurance companies as a subsidy to administer higher levels of crop insurance coverage. The idea of a permanent disaster program may have merit, especially when you consider the Congress's past legislation to fund ad hoc disaster payment assistance nearly every year for the last 20 years. But we should ask ourselves if the current expensive farm bill is failing to provide a safety net to farmers when these devastating events do happen, then what is the purpose of the farm bill? Why do we need a new program administered by a separate federal agency to fulfill what most Americans believe is the core purpose of the legislation before us? We should fix the root problem, namely that the current subsidy system does not work and waste taxpayer dollars. Well, Mr. President, if you are now a farm landowner in America, it is highly probable that your land will increase in value. Why? Because a landowning farmer or agriculture business can count upon receiving substantially more money through subsidies. As a result, you are able to leverage your land and crops to expand. If you are one of hundreds of thousands of farmers in this country who rent land as opposed to owning land, you face a very tough set of circumstances. Your rents are likely to go up each year as the value of the land goes up. Worse still, if you are a young farmer who hopes someday to own land, then your prospects diminish year by year. As a result, there are young members of farm families who are hopeful that with the reduction or repeal of federal estate taxes, that they might inherit the land. Other young people who are interested in farming are simply out of luck, as it is too difficult to get into the business. So as a result, it is predictable that the average age of farmers in this country will continue to increase, as it's been increasing in recent decades. Consider the fact that 6% of farmers are younger than 35, while 26% are over 65 years of age. Furthermore, elderly farmers who may be land rich but cash poor will be more inclined to sell their farms as their retirement nest egg. The most likely buyer of that farm is an owner of a larger farm who is in a position to expand thanks to government subsidies. In spite of all of the rhetoric and all of the attempts to talk about perpetuating the small family farms or even the medium-sized farm, the facts are that consolidation is increasing, and this bill will perpetuate that cycle. I want to emphasize this point because it reflects the inequity of this entire bill. Our farm policies transfer a great deal of money from ordinary taxpayers to a few farmers. If this transfer from the many to the few produced a stable farm economy with prospects for greater trade success, perhaps one could argue that this approach is more justified. Further, these policies could be justified if they truly did support the lower to middle class farmer and reduce the number of farm consolidations. I am arguing that our policies promote the exact opposite. For all of these reasons, Senator Frank Lautenberg and I, along with Senators Hatch, Reed, Menendez, Cardin, Collins, Domenici, McCain, and Whitehouse are introducing an amendment today that would provide a true safety net for all farmers, regardless of what they grow or where they live. For the first time, each farmer would receive at no cost either expanded county-based crop insurance policies that would cover 85% of expected crop revenue, or 80% of a farm's five-year average adjusted gross revenue. These subsidized insurance tools already exist, but our reforms would make them more effective and universally used while controlling administrative costs. Farmers would also be able to purchase insurance to cover the remainder of their revenue and yields. The 85% county-level policy simply looks at the expected revenue annually in each county in the United States for crops such as corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton, and rice, but it can be expanded under this bill to any commodity so long as adequate market information is available to satisfy actuarial concerns. The USDA uses prices from the futures market in late February and multiplies them by past county average crop yields collected by the National Agricultural Statistics Service, which keeps detailed data on virtually every agricultural product produced in the United States. This creates a target price that adjusts either up or down each year to market conditions and yields and yield trends. Farmers would receive a safety net payment when the actual county revenue for a crop they are growing falls below 85% of the target revenue. This program ensures that the only incentive to grow a crop is the market, not federally set prices under the farm policies before the Senate today. For example, in Marion County, Indiana, where my farm is located, expected yields for corn in 2006 were 146 bushels an acre. The future price for corn in late February 2006 was $2.59 a bushel. So, target revenue for corn was $378 an acre. After the harvest, USDA found that actual corn yields in Marion County were 140 bushels an acre, and that harvest prices were $3.03 a bushel, producing average revenue of $424 an acre. Actual revenue exceeded target revenue, so that no additional subsidies were paid to corn farmers in Marion County in 2006. By contrast, corn farmers in Baca County, Colorado, experienced poor weather. Expected yields were 161 bushels an acre, and the future price for corn was $2.59 a bushel. So expected revenue was $418 an acre. After the harvest, USDA found that actual yields were much lower at 116 bushels an acre, and even though the harvest price of $3.03 a bushel was higher than expected, the actual average revenue was $50 an acre. Since actual revenue was only 83% of target revenue, corn farmers in Baca County would have received $5.30 per acre under the safety net, or the difference between actual revenue in that county and the 85% guarantee. The other choice would allow farmers to protect against adverse change in their own historic average revenues. This program looks at the whole farm, recognizing the same risks exist for an apple orchard as the soybean field on the same farm. A farm's five-year average adjusted revenue is calculated using annual tax forms. The adjusted revenue is essentially a farm's overall revenue minus expenses, as indicated on the tax forms. When a farm's adjusted revenue falls below 80% of that five-year average, a safety net payment makes up the difference. This program is currently operating as a pilot program in a number of states, but has been limited to the amount of revenues that can be covered for some agricultural products, such as livestock and forest products. Our bill expands the program, expands it nationwide, and allows the USDA to include more agricultural products. It also requires USDA to minimize double payments under situations where farmers may also have products covered by remaining farm support programs, namely the sugar program and the milk income loss program. In addition, this bill creates optional risk management accounts that will be available to every farmer and rancher and will work in concert with crop and revenue insurance. Producers who are eligible for direct payments would receive transition payments phased out over the next 5 years, which would be deposited into their accounts. They would then be eligible to withdraw from their available balance of those accounts to supplement their income in years when their gross revenue falls below 95% of their rolling five-year average gross revenue. They could invest in a rural enterprise, purchase additional revenue or crop insurance, or upon retirement, utilize it as a farmer retirement account. These accounts provide farmers who are generally asset-rich and cash-poor greater incentive to save for the future and will help maintain family farms by providing retirement benefits without forcing a liquidation of farm assets. The Fresh Act that I'm introducing today, the Fresh Act Amendments, which we are introducing today, the Farm Bill, is important because savings from these reforms will allow us to provide an additional $6.1 billion more than the underlying bill in new investments to assist farmers with conservation practices, to encourage rural development, to develop renewable energy, to expand access to healthy foods for children and consumers, and assist more hungry Americans. Our amendment provides an additional $1 billion for important environmental and conservation programs. I am pleased that we were able to expand and improve USDA's voluntary conservation incentive programs, which provide financial and technical assistance to farmers, ranchers, and forest landowners who offer to take steps to prevent soil erosion and improve water quality, air quality, and wildlife habitats. Since 2003, roughly two-thirds of farmers seeking assistance through USDA conservation programs have been rejected due to insufficient funding. Most of these conservation programs are cost-share programs. That means that farmers are offering to put their own money into environmental improvements from which the public benefits. We are missing an opportunity to utilize private dollars to produce environmental benefits such as cleaner water and cleaner air when we underfund cost-share conservation programs. One of the most popular of these programs, the Environmental Quality Incentive Program, EQIP, has had an application backlog that has averaged $1.6 billion a year over the last 4 years. Yet the Farm Bill before us provides no increase in funding for this popular conservation program. The current Farm Bill also provides no increase in funding for the Farmland Protection Program. This program is critical because in many areas, our working farms and ranches are under tremendous developmental pressures. From 1992 to 1997, this country lost more than 6 million acres of agricultural land, an area the size of the state of Maryland, to development. And yet this bill doesn't provide the funding needed to assist state and local governments and private land trusts in important work they do to conserve our nation's farmland. Increasing funding for the Farm Bill's conservation programs also provides another way to make our farm policies more equitable. All producers can be eligible to participate in conservation programs, regardless of what they grow or where they grow it. By contrast, only producers of a handful of commodity crops can participate in commodity programs. And while discussion of commodity policy dominates much of the Farm Bill debate and discretionary funding, production agriculture remains a comparatively small and shrinking part of the rural economy. Farm employment has fallen from just 14% of total employment in 1969 to 6% in 2005. The number of counties with farm employment accounting for even 20% or more of total employment has shrunk dramatically from 1,148 in 1969 to just 348 in 2005. Furthermore, only one in 75 Americans, one in 75 Americans lives on a farm today. And nearly 90% of total farm household income comes from off-farm sources. Despite this fundamental shift, the 2002 Farm Bill committed 69% of total spending to commodity payments, thus another 13% to conservation payments, and in all, 4/5 of the total funding went to a select few farmers, while only 0.7% went to rural development initiatives aimed at boosting overall rural economies. We now have evidence which suggests that direct payments to farmers have little positive impact on rural economies. A recent study revealed that most payment-dependent counties did not even match the national average in terms of job growth from 1992 to 2002. In fact, many experienced losses during that time. Furthermore, most of these payment-dependent counties experienced population losses during that same time period. Such job and population loss figures suggest that our current system of support for overall rural communities, which rely on farm subsidies like direct payments, does not work. Well, Mr. President, I'm also pleased that the amendment we are offering expands agriculture markets and decreases oil dependency by dramatically increasing research and development efforts for cellulosic ethanol and other renewable funds, and expanding clean, renewable energy opportunities to all of our rural areas. This is an area of considerable interest to the chairman, who has been a stalwart supporter. Today's growth in ethanol production is creating jobs and bringing new sources of revenue into our communities. Because of our energy demand, we are witness to a palpable sense of optimism in rural communities for economic growth in areas that have stagnated under the current Farm Bill. Failure to give clear and strong government commitment in the Farm Bill to developing biofuels from diverse feedstocks has unnecessarily confined new markets to Midwestern states rich in corn. Spreading the economic benefits of biofuel production nationwide will require breakthroughs in technology and agricultural techniques to make more fuels from farm, municipal, and industrial waste available from coast to coast. Strong support in the Farm Bill will help galvanize private investment and bring jobs across the country. Yet the opportunity before us involves more than economic growth. Dramatic advancements in biofuels will help build a more secure and self-reliant America by reducing our dependence on foreign oil. Global competition for oil continues to grow as demand soars and oil-rich states tighten their control over supplies. Already we have witnessed Russia cut its exports to selected countries for political gain, and the governments of Iran and Venezuela have threatened to do the same. Each year, Americans spend hundreds of billions of dollars to import oil. Some of that money enriches authoritarian governments that suppress their own people and work against the United States. Meanwhile, oil infrastructure is being targeted by terrorists, and in today's tight oil market, even a small disruption in oil supplies could cause shortages and send prices much higher than the $90-plus barrel prices Americans have paid in recent days. Biofuels will not make America completely independent of energy imports, but they can strengthen our leverage over oil-rich regimes hostile to the United States, give greater freedom to our policy options in the Middle East, help protect our economy, and foster rural development. Reaping the economic and energy security benefits of biofuels and other rural renewable energy requires breakthroughs in research and incentives for infrastructure development. Our amendment provides an additional $500 million to transform renewable energy opportunity into reality. Mr. President, during the markup of the Agriculture Committee, I offered an amendment to increase nutrition funding in the Farm Bill by almost $1.6 billion through cuts to direct payments. Unfortunately, my amendment was defeated 17-4. However, the amendment sparked constructive bipartisan debate on the importance of strong funding for administration programs to provide a safety net for people across our country who are on the cusp of poverty. I'm thankful to Senators Harkin and Chambliss for taking that discussion seriously and, as a result, using the savings generated from a committee change to the underlying bill to provide additional funding for the nutrition title of this farm bill. But even as I applaud the efforts of the Agriculture Committee members for their attention to nutrition programs, I have serious concerns that the nutrition program in this bill is essentially authorized for only 5 years. At the end of the 5 years, Senators should understand, funding for nutrition programs drops dramatically. In 2012, we would then be faced with having to manipulate the budget to find additional funding for these programs, or vulnerable Americans would lose this much-needed assistance. This is because the agriculture bill before us is front-loading spending during the first 5 years and virtually zeroing out nutrition spending for years 6 through 10. So the bill would come out budget neutral on paper, but will cost taxpayers handsomely in reality. This is just one of many budgetary tricks performed so that the scoring works out favorably without regard to the practical application of such maneuvers. In our amendment, nutrition programs would not end. In fact, we increased funding for these important programs by $2 billion over the underlying farm bill and make these funding increases permanent. We cannot and should not build a safety net with holes. Mr. President, this leads me to another benefit of our reform proposal. Our amendment provides critical funding for each of these priorities and yet pays for itself from the existing agriculture budget passed by Congress without employing deceptive budgetary maneuvers. In fact, our bill will save taxpayers $4 billion. Unfortunately, this is not the case with the underlying bill, and if you take a thorough look, you realize just how precarious that bill's budget situation truly is. In fact, the Bush administration's statement of administrative policy highlighted a number of budget gimmicks used to make the farm bill pay go compliant, at least on paper. The Fresh Act that we are offering, that amendment today, is fully paid for, fiscally responsible, and provides a framework for growth for farmers and rural communities. Furthermore, long-term budgetary savings from our proposal will allow for us to make considerable investments in key priority areas. Mr. President, there is an inappropriate political assumption that agriculture policy is impenetrable for consumers, taxpayers, the poor, and the vast majority of Americans who are being asked to pay for these subsidies while getting little in return. Even if only a small number of farmers in a state raise a program crop or one of the protected specialty crops such as milk, sugar, or peanuts, their focused advocacy somehow has more political influence than the broader well-being of consumers and taxpayers. In short, those who benefit from current agriculture programs are virtually the only participants in the debate. This fact is probably best illustrated by the fact that one of the most contentious debates on this bill has been whether farmers with incomes of over $1 million a year after farm expenses have been paid should continue to receive subsidies. I have even seen media reports that indicate that if a payment limitation amendment were passed, the farm bill could be filibustered. That the median household income for Americans for 2006 was $48,200. Their average income of a food stamp recipient is less than $10,000. There is also an ongoing reluctance to consider change. Members will say, quote, farming is conservative by nature. You can't demand too much change, end of quote. But in 2002, I offered a similar type of reform proposal, and opponents argued that the proposal was too new, too radical, required too much change. You will hear that same baseless argument today. Mr. President, members of the Senate, where is the time for reform? When will we fix this broken system? When will we act on the clear evidence before us? As senators, we clearly must understand our responsibility. And whether we understand all the complexities of our current farm programs, we know where the money goes. The bulk of the money in the underlying farm bill goes to a very few farmers, a very few. That has been clear throughout. This is not a great humanitarian effort. This does not save the family farmer, the low-income farmer, or even the middle-income farmer. This bill is about making choices. And it's incredible to me that with all of the budgetary pressures we're facing to fund critical needs such as providing better health insurance coverage for Americans, protecting Social Security and pension saving, improving education, increasing border security, providing our men and women in the armed forces with appropriate pay and equipment, we would consider a bill that enriches so few individuals. I believe this year's farm bill debate is a good time to begin changing these dynamics. This year, an unconventional alliance of conservation, humanitarian, business, and taxpayer advocate groups has entered the fray with success in framing the issue and building support for the Fresh Act that we introduce in this amendment. They represent the broadest ever political support for change. Newspapers in at least 41 states have written editorials in support of changing our farm programs to a fair, trade-compliant, and fiscally responsible system. And I have distributed these articles to all of my colleagues. Perhaps more importantly, there has never been a better time for farmers to change. Thanks to strong foreign and domestic demand for energy crops, net farm income is forecast to be $87 billion this year, up $28 billion from 2006 and $30 billion above the average for the previous 10 years. As a result, average farm household income is projected to almost $87,000 in 2007, up 8% from 2006, and 15% above the five-year average between 2002 and 2006, and I might point out well above median U.S. household incomes. Farm revenue may be high today, but this will not always be the case. It's critical we have an appropriate safety net in place to assist these farmers during times of need. Agriculture policy is too important for rural America and the economic and budgetary health of our country to continue the current misguided path. Our amendment provides a much more equitable approach, produces higher net farm income for farmers, increases farm exports, avoids stimulating overproduction, and gives more emphasis to environmental, nutritional, energy security, and research concerns. More importantly, Mr. President, this proposal will protect the family farmer through a strong safety net and encourage rural development in a fiscally responsible and trade-compliant manner. I thank the Chair.